Today's Tesho will be on Case 2 in the Book of Serenity, Bodhidharma's Emptiness. Introduction. A man presented a jewel 3 times but didn't escape punishment. When a luminous jewel is thrown to anyone, few do not draw their sword. For an impromptu guest, there is no impromptu host. What's appropriate provisionally is not appropriate for the real. If unusual treasures and rare jewels cannot be put to use, I'll bring out the head of a dead cat. Look. Case. Emperor Wu of Liang asked great teacher Bodhidharma, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" Bodhidharma said, "Emptiness, no holiness." The emperor said, "Who are you facing me?" Bodhidharma said, "Don't know." The emperor didn't understand. Bodhidharma subsequently crossed the Yangtze River and came to Shaolin and faced a wall for 9 years. Verse. Empty, nothing holy. The approach is far off. Succeeding, he swings the axe without injuring the nose. Failing, he drops the pitcher without looking back. Still and silent, coolly he sat at Shaolin. In silence, he completely brought up the true imperative. The clear moon of autumn turns its frosty disk. The Milky Way thin, the dipper hangs down its handle in the night. In succession, the robe and bowl have been imparted to descendants. From this, humans and divinities have made medicine and disease. To thank you all for doing such an excellent job this morning. Everybody's really sitting deeply, and it was very moving, very beautiful to sit with you this morning. The beautiful sound of the rain. I guess we all love sun. We all love sunny days. They're beautiful. But there's something about these rainy days, and these rainy mornings, sitting in the rain, it's just so beautiful. It's really autumn, right? And it's a little warm for autumn. It almost feels like summer, but the leaves are turning. This morning there was a mist over everything, and then the rain came. So beautiful to sit in the rain, to do zazen listening to the rain. I just think it's the most precious thing in the world. And everybody was doing such a good job this morning. It's day 3, and I'm sure everybody's tired, but people just sat beautifully. It's a real pleasure, it's a real honor to practice with you all. Everyone here is doing a wonderful job. And I can't tell you how much it means to me. It's really wonderful. I can't help but think, you know, about my own earlier life in Zen, in Sesshin, where I was sitting, maybe where you're sitting, with about the same amount of experience, and listening to the rain. And I wondered where my teachers are right now, and what they're doing. And just such a precious moment, so beautiful. I hope you've had a few moments like that. You keep practicing, if you haven't, but you keep practicing open-heartedly, wholeheartedly, you surely will. And the thing is, why is it so beautiful? Why is it so beautiful? It's the strangest thing, isn't it? You know, you've gotten up on hundreds, maybe thousands of rainy days. You know, and maybe this morning you were sitting here too thinking, this is so beautiful, listen to the raindrops. Listen to the rainfall, maybe the distant cry of birds. And got up and looked at the mist. And it's like enchanted, like enchanted. And my wife is from New Mexico, and on the license plate it says Land of Enchantment. But for people who do Zazen, New Jersey license plates should also say Land of Enchantment. It's true. Nobody will understand except people who do Zazen, huh? But also, New Jersey is also the Land of Enchantment, even in the midst of all this chaos, right? It's just so beautiful. How does it get so beautiful? How does it get so beautiful? You know, everybody has these experiences if they stay with Zen long enough. You go to sit in the evening, and you sit, and maybe it's a struggle, and you have the thoughts of the day. And then you come again, and then one day you're sitting on the cushion, and it's just so beautiful. And you look at that cookie, which is made by the Pepperidge Farm Company, and you eat it, and you think, damn, that is so good, right? And then you have some tea. I think we've been drinking some delicious tea that Yvette brought to us. And you think, oh, this tea. This tea is so delicious. The tea we've been drinking at the university. Why is it so beautiful? Why is it so delicious? You know, you've had thousands of cups of your, if you're a tea drinker like me, you have 3 cups of tea every day, you've had plenty of tea. Why is that tea so beautiful? Why are the, you've heard millions of crickets. Now why is the cricket sometimes so beautiful? So beautiful, right? And, oh, that's just heartbreakingly beautiful. This rain is just heartbreakingly beautiful. Why? Why is it so? You can say, well, we've been sitting, but what does that really mean? So what is it? What is it? So this is the story of a famous Zen story. Very simple. Story is in both the Wu Men Quan and in the Book of Serenity, and I believe it's even in the Blue Rock collection. I may be mistaken about that, but I think it's in all 3 collections. As you may know, Bodhidharma was a great yogin. He was a great meditation master from India. And when he was rather elderly, he left India and he went to China. And came to China at a time when Buddhism was already well represented. There were many different schools of Buddhism, and people were practicing all kinds of practices. There was quite a building boom going on. I mean, this was the emperor, right? So he had at his disposal large resources, and he was using them to build beautiful temples, lovely gardens, monasteries, nunneries, all over his domain. And every day he would get up and think, oh, this Buddhism is really great. I'm really helping the advance of Buddhism. And was endowing scholars from India and overseeing the translation of texts. And it was just a wonderful thing. And it's a wonderful moment in the history of China, the history of Buddhism in China, this moment. And Bodhidharma came to China and had an emperor interview with the emperor. This is a very, very unusual moment, right? A Zen monk a monk from India coming and having an interview with the Emperor of China. And he's brought before the Emperor, and this is his chance, so to speak, right? I mean, this is his big opportunity. And he's going to present his case for this particular form of practice. And the Emperor is going to listen, and hopefully he'll say, okay, I'm going to endow you with a big temple. And you can practice in a beautiful place up in the mountains, and so on and so on. And then they have this conversation. And it's so important to remember this, you know, because some of you may go for job interviews and not get your job interview. Yeah? This is like a failed job interview. Okay? I'll never forget when I was finishing up in graduate school, I decided that I wanted to get out of the academic world and go into business, because I thought I could make more money and help my sangha. And I was making, at that time, about $16,000 a year as a lecturer, which it doesn't seem like much now. And it wasn't really much then, but it was quite sufficient, believe it or not. And I went to an interview with a company called the TRW, and they do all kinds of high-tech projects. And I went for the interview, and I was a finalist for the interview. And they flew my wife and me to DC, put us up in a hotel, gave us like spending money. It was like, oh my gosh, man. Really? You know, spending money just so you'll put it, go eat at the restaurant, put it on our tab, you know. And we had no car, you know. We used to go to the grocery store with our backpacks on, this kind of thing. So this was just amazing. And I didn't get the job. I'm so glad I didn't get the job. But at the time, it just was such a crushing blow. And my wife, she's very very strong person, but she just cried. She actually burst into tears. It just looked like this amazing world was opening up for us. I'm so glad I didn't get that job. So many things have happened because I didn't get the job. But we've all been there, right? You know, that was looked like the most wonderful opportunity in the world. And Bodhidharma goes to see the emperor, and he's supposed to say to the emperor, well, here's what Zen is about. And the emperor's supposed to go, oh, I get it. Wonderful. You know, I'll write you a check. You know. It's the fifth century version of a check. I don't know what that would be. But anyway, it doesn't happen. Right? The emperor asks Bodhidharma, he says, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? You know, the emperor has heard this as a very famous meditation master. And maybe he's been, you know, getting ready. He's a good man. You know, Emperor Wu of Liang is a good man. He has a good heart. And he's been studying the sutras. And he's really prepared for this interview with this man named Bodhidharma. And he says, what's the meaning, highest meaning of the holy truths? This is like earnest question. But unfortunately, he's dealing with a Zen monk, right? If he were dealing with somebody from another school, the person would say, ah, okay, so let me explain. You know, there's the relative and there's the absolute. You know, when the Buddha taught, he taught this way, when he taught the But no, this is a Zen monk. So Bodhidharma doesn't do any of that. Emperor Wu of Liang says, what is the highest meaning of the holy truth? Bodhidharma says, there is no truth. There is no holiness. Just vast emptiness. Right? So he says this to the emperor, who has been getting up every day and building monasteries and temples and thinking to himself, holy, 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 sacred, 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 sacred. Now, what a wonderful thing. And Bodhidharma says, there's no such thing as the sacred, there's no such thing as the holy, there's no universal truth, there's just the heart of it all is emptiness. See? And the emperor is maybe hurt. Now this is like, Bodhidharma has said all the things he's doing are not that important. A trivial. And the emperor is taken aback, but I think he's such a good man. You know, he doesn't get mad. He says, "Who are you, basically?" And Bodhidharma says, "I don't know. I don't know. The emperor didn't understand. Bodhidharma subsequently crossed the Yangtze River and came to Shaolin and faced a wall for 9 years. You know, let's say you want to spread Chan in China. You've come all the way from India. Your time is limited because you're old, right? And you want to get the word out. So what do? You're Bodhidharma. You go to meet the emperor, and it doesn't click. The emperor doesn't understand what the heck you're talking about. So you just leave. And you go up into the mountains, and of course, you could, if this were America, Bodhidharma would write a book, right? And it would be, 10 Steps to Enlightened Mind by Bodhidharma Bhikkhu, right? And he would be on with Matt Lauer, and Matt would say, "Well, tell us, Bodhidharma, you know, what is this?" And he'd say, "Well, Matt, you know." But that's not what happens. He goes up and he sits in a cave up in the mountain. He sits there. And the people who live there are probably, they might be Buddhists or they might be Taoists. So they're familiar with people, hermits, living in caves, holy hermits living in caves, men and women who just go up and live in nature. And they take Bodhidharma food, they're offering the food and leave it in his cave. And he sits in the cave and he faces a wall and practices Pequan for 9 years. This is everything. If all the other koans were destroyed and all the books on Buddhism were destroyed, this story would pretty much get the whole point across. You know? It's just the case that we live in a very small world, you and I. That we get up every day and we worry about all kinds of things, and they seem so consequential at the time. They seem so consequential at the time. I can remember, when I was young, my family moved to a place called Bel Air, outside of Washington, D.C. It's Bel Air, Maryland. And it was a huge tract development. In other words, these were houses built for people after World War II. After World War II, all of these soldiers came back from the war, and they wanted to own a home. There wasn't enough housing in the United States, so companies would build huge developments. And this place went on for miles, and it was just, there were four kinds of houses, four models and four colors. And this was like, you alternated house models. There was one called the Country Club, there was one called the Colonial, there was the Ranch and the Cape Cod. So it was like, Country Club, Colonial, Ranch, Cape Cod. Ranch, you know, so they vary them a little bit. And there were like four colors, like yellow, blue, I can't remember, green was one, and I can't remember what the other one was, but there were no red houses, just three, four colors. And it was, you know, it was sort of rolling hills, So as far as the eye could see, there were just these houses, right? And we lived there, and there was nothing for us to do. There wasn't a tree in any direction, right? You could look around, any trees, no. There were schools, and the schools had playgrounds, but they were pretty far from our house. There was actually no place to play. So we were really bored, and my mother got me into what was called the 4-H Club. And this was a 4-H Club really started in the United States when people used to live on farms. And the people in the 4-H Club do projects like raise cows. You know, they take calves and try to raise good calves or good chickens. And 4-H really is like from a time a century ago, really, in the United States, when we were an agricultural society. And there was a 4-H club in this town because it used to be, there used to be farms where all these houses were. So I joined this 4-H club, and I along with some other kids from our neighborhood, and they voted me to be the secretary. And the secretary's job is to keep the minutes of the meeting, right? And I had a minute book, which is an official 4-H Club minute book. And, you know, you were supposed to write the date, and then you were supposed to write the minutes. And I was really only like 10 years old, you know. I should never have been given this job, right? So I would go to the meetings, and people would talk, and I would, you know, pretend to write things down on a pad of paper. And there was a woman, I can't remember her name, I think her name was Mrs. Sapienza. But she'd say, "Kurt, are you taking this down?" And I'd go, "Yes." And I'd draw some little faces on the pad. You know. And then I would go home and forget all about it, you know, forget all that, you know, whatever, watch TV or do it, you know. And eventually, Mrs. Sapienza began to say, "Oh, your term is coming up now. You're ending your term as secretary. I need the minute book." And I was like seized with terror, right? Because, you know, I had the minute book. There was like, I think, you know, it takes great concentration to do something like discipline, and I had no concentration and no discipline, you know. And my mother was so busy taking care of us. My father was overseas on a naval station overseas. And we were living in this strange place. And, you know, I think I started to write the minutes for one meeting, and I got tired, and I just quit, right? I don't know, maybe other little kids were different, but this was how I was as a little kid. And so I had the minute book, and... But anyway, she kept pestering me for the minute book, and I actually dropped out of a 4-H club because I couldn't bear it. I couldn't sleep. I was so worried. I cried, you know. And she wouldn't leave me alone, you know. I mean, I said, "I lost the minute book." And, you know, she said, "You lost it, you know. I don't believe you, you know." And indeed, I hadn't lost it. It was in my house, but there were no minutes. And I just thought, "Oh my God, I haven't taken minutes," you know. And I didn't really even know what minutes were, you know, or why anybody would want them, you know. I'm leading a committee at the university right now, and I do the minutes, you know? And I do an excellent job, you know. This is 50 years later, or almost 45 years later. I take careful notes, and after the meeting, I go to my office and I spend like hours writing up the minutes. And somebody has actually said to me, "You know, you write excellent minutes." And it's like, "Well, it's only taken me 45 years." but the truth is, that was terrifying to me as a little kid. I mean, it was horrible. It was just horrible. And I can remember at the same time, you know, we had moved into this development at Bel Air, Maryland. If you're ever in Maryland and you're driving through, you might want to just take a look at it. Because it's not, I would just say it's a place you wouldn't want to live, you know. but you know, my brother was going to school, and he had no friends in his class, and he had a very mean teacher. She was indeed quite mean. Her name was Mrs. Nelson. And I can remember her name even now. And my brother, you know, was so afraid to go to school that he actually gets sick to his stomach, you know. And he was, I don't know, there was something, Mrs. Nelson had said something to him about his shirt or something. It just, you know, made him so fearful of going to class that he actually would try to get out of going to school. He was just so frightened of Mrs. Nelson. And I'm sure, even though she was rather mean, I'm sure she wasn't cruel, you know. So, we really, little kids live in this world where, you know, small things are enormously important. You know, and little kids have a very difficult life, I think, because they're expected to function in the world, but they don't know anything about the world. It's like, you know, I was appointed to keep the minutes, but the only minutes I knew were like minutes on the hand of a clock, you know, and I didn't know about minutes of a meeting, and I didn't know what they were for, and I got so frightened, you know, I was, you know, afraid to answer the phone because it might be Mrs. Sapienza calling for those minutes, you know, and my poor brother was afraid of his teacher, and, you know, this is the way of little kids, right? You know, we make things so, we don't know so much, or we worry so much, you know. When you get old, I guess it's still possible to be worried, but sometimes when you're old, you have a bigger perspective, you know. When I was in college, I had a job at one time moving furniture for the Mayflower Moving Company, and I had this wonderful job moving furniture. I love moving furniture. I did, you know. At that time, I was in very good shape, and I was living in Charlottesville, Virginia. And you know, my job was to show up at around 7 at the Mayflower Company, and basically we would all go out on a truck and move somebody's apartment or somebody's house from one place to another. And you know, you'd spend maybe all day loading up a truck, and you'd have to pack it into the back of the truck very carefully with blankets. There's special blankets to pack. And you get it all packed up with straps. It all has to be strapped in so nothing will shift. And then maybe the next day you ride out to South Carolina or something, and you unpack it, and then you come back. And you know, the lunches are on the company, you know, it's fun. You get to see a lot of country. I loved it, you know. And it was great. One day, we got a call. It was a slow day. And we got a call from a woman whose husband was incapacitated. And she didn't need us to move furniture. She just needed us to come out to her house and do some unpacking. And she was quite elderly. And when we got there, I got there with two other guys who were like a professional mover men. And I was the kid, you know, in the group. And the situation was this, you know, in their house, I came into the house, and there was a man sitting on the bed. And the bed was propped up on blocks. It was a four-post bed, you know, with four posts on each corner of the bed. And it was propped up on blocks so that he could see out the window. And it was in a beautiful place. It was like a country setting. There were fields and everything. And he looked out his window, he could see fields. He was very sick. You know, he was like dying. He had long gray hair. And his wife had been crying, looked very careworn. But his face was like luminous. As I was walking through their house, I saw all these books on Buddhism. There were like the library shelf and filled with like Tibetan Buddha, Book of the Dead. You know, there were all these books on Buddhism and Vedanta and all of this other stuff. Hindu tradition. And it turns out that they had been living in India for years and years, and that he was a famous painter. He was like this famous painter. And he had come back to the United States. They had both come back after years and years, probably because he was sick. And he had, was, you know, quite well known, I guess. He wasn't like a Jackson Pollock type painter. He was a realist painter. They had stored a lot of the paintings he had done over the years in a warehouse. And the warehouse had leaked on all of these oil paintings. They were in crates, wooden crates. And they were put into the crate, you know, they weren't rolled, they were flat in these crates, and there were pieces of paper between the oil paintings. And some of the oil paintings were on the floor of this big room in their house. And they were beautiful. They were like 19th century paintings of, you know, Jaipur and other places. They had been to Ethiopia. They had been all over the world, at China. And they were really good. You know, they're out of style now. They were out of style then. But they were beautifully executed. And you know, you could see this was a guy who was really a master. And this was their old age policy, and now it was wrecked, you know. And the thing was that, you know, she was so despondent. She was pulling these out of the box and out of the crate. And, you know, you could see she had been crying. She didn't know what was going to happen. It wasn't just the money. This was like her husband's life work. And some of these paintings were really beautiful. I wish I could convey to you how beautiful they were. Like, you know, like a castle on a mountainside, and it was just beautifully done, paintings like that, or river, or a Chinese temple. But the thing was, you know, I didn't get to talk to the guy, but his face was so pure and luminous, and I just knew he had seen something. You know, I just knew it. And I got very excited in his presence. I just felt the way I felt later when I met Genki Roshi. I just felt very excited. Like, I've got to know this secret. I've got to know this secret. And we spent the day unpacking these paintings, and then that was the last I ever saw of them. But you know, he had a perspective that's different from the perspective of a little kid, you know. Some people, at the end of their lives, they found something, and they don't care anymore. You know, we still have to go through our lives. We still have troubles, you know, but you know, when we're little kids, it just terrorizes us because we're so afraid. We don't know, you know, and we think it all matters. It's like, where are your minutes? And I'm like, God, I don't have the minutes. It doesn't, you know, I see now. I should have just gone to Mrs. Sapienza and said, Mrs. Sapienza, I'm only 10 years old, you know. Really. And this is beyond my intellectual capacity, you know. But I didn't, because I was too afraid. I just thought, you know, you don't know what can be done and what can't be done and what can be said. So you're always wrong. You know, a lot of times little kids just go through life, they're just always wrong. They're always catching, you're always in trouble because you've always done something that you didn't know wasn't supposed to be done, right? Just so often, it's the life of a little kid. Yeah. But at the end of your life, you know, sometimes people realize, well, it's over. You know, there's no sense worrying. It's all over. And sometimes there's this beautiful freedom. There's this beautiful, you know, at the end of your life, you realize there's nothing more to be accomplished. What's done is done. You know, that was that. You know, the drama has unfolded, and, you know. And now I'm just left with the rain on a morning. You know, all that's left is this beautiful rain and this beautiful morning and the sound of crickets. I guess you can be old and still be unhappy, but sometimes old people find the secret. Some of it just comes from letting it all go. Why not let it go? You know, there's nothing to hold on to. It's all gone. And that's really, you know, the secret of our practice. You know, it's part of the secret anyway. You know, it's interesting that After Emperor Wu of Liang built all those beautiful temples, Buddhism flourished in China till maybe 800, something like that, 800. And then there was a Confucian revival, and a new emperor, different emperor. And they decided that they had to exterminate Buddhism. It was very bad because people weren't doing what they were supposed to do. They weren't loyal subjects. They were too busy trying to become enlightened. And they weren't making money, and they weren't making money for the emperor. They were paying taxes. They weren't becoming soldiers so the emperor could conquer more property, and so on and so on. They weren't women weren't having 20 children, so there would be cheap labor and 20 soldiers. And they said, we have to exterminate this Buddhism. And all those temples were destroyed, almost all of them. Very few temples survived that purge. And if Buddhism were just about temples, if it were just about books, and so on, it would be gone. The ancient history, you'd be in a library and you'd say, what was that all about? But there's something deeper. Whether temples are built or not built, whether they're created or destroyed, you might live to be 100, you might live to be 50. Actually, all of this is quite trivial. In my life and my death also. It's like the surface, the thin surface. And under that thin surface, there's something so much deeper. We never look at it because we're too inattentive, and we're too inattentive because we're too afraid. But there's a way to get there. Yeah? And the door is Wuxing. When you sit on the cushion and you call Wu or Mu, and you follow that breath to that darkness or that blankness, it may seem a little frightening at first. You might say, oh, the abyss. Well, isn't it interesting? If humans really are a creature who has the abyss right there, when you close your eyes, you're right in the abyss, that's very interesting, isn't it? That's actually true in a way. That's what humans are. We're creatures who literally are on the surface of a so-called abyss. Right? And no wonder we're so crazy. Right? It's a little scary. But if you go into that so-called abyss long enough, you realize this is not so bad. In fact, this is quite wonderful. It's the Dharma door to enlightenment. It's the Dharma door to enlightenment. It's big mind. It's big mind. And the world on the other side of that door or that wall, that blankness, that darkness, is the wall that Bodhidharma looked at for 9 years. The world on the other side of that wall is vast beyond belief. So help me. So help me. With my whole being, please, let me ask you, please believe me. It's vast beyond belief. It's wonderful beyond belief. It's a bigger world on the other side of that door. But, when the little mind looks at the door, it just sees a blank surface, just blackness. And the little mind just says, ah, nothing's there. There's nothing there, nothing. Or it gets frightened and says, oh, it is. But little mind can never understand big mind. It's not the case that if you practice 50 years from now, when you look at that blankness, it's going to look different. Because when you look at it through the eyes of little mind, it's always going to be blank and dark. See, little mind can't comprehend enlightenment. It can't. And trying to figure out your problem, if you have some obstacle on the cushion, yeah, and you're trying to figure out how to overcome it, you'll never overcome it that way. That's like trying to clean dirt with dirt. Right? You can't think your way out of thinking. That's not possible. So what you have to do is go deeply into nushing, deeply into ushing. If you have pain in your legs, go into ushing. There's no other way. There's no way to practice. There's no way to practice for sashin. This is it. You know, unless you're sitting 8 or 9 hours every day, you can't really practice for sashin at home. Right? This is it. So you have to deal with your pain here. You have to deal with your distractions here. There's no other place. You can't put it off because there's not going to be another opportunity until the next sashin. So this is like a rare opportunity to come face to face with this vastness that's inside us all, really and truly. And it's so wonderful that you're doing it. Everybody's doing a wonderful job. But please don't be afraid of It's the most. There's nothing there that can hurt you. Absolutely. And please take advantage of it. In other words, you know, you're sitting on the cushion and your mind is full of thoughts. You know, you have to. There's only one way to solve the problem. Actually, pull your legs up over your thigh, and that's sad but true, right? You know, you take your leg and you put it up on your thigh and you go, "Ow!" Right? "Ow!" And that just cuts through all the crap, doesn't it? You know. You're sitting on the cushion and you're sort of comfortable and your mind's buzzing away, right? You think, gee, how can I stop thinking? I have a solution, right? Take your foot and put it up on, pull it up a little higher on your thigh and you do it and you think, ow! Right? And you're sitting there and you're thinking, oh, this is very uncomfortable, right? And it's just that, it just eats right through all your thoughts, just like magic, right? And then, you know, you have that pain, and you say, here it comes, the pain, what am I going to do? You can't think your way out of it. You know, if you have pain in your legs, just try it. Think, okay, I'm on a beautiful island. It's not going to work, right? Imagination is no match for the pain, right? So it just immediately crumbles. You can't even do it. So you just have to go into move. You just jump into that blankness for dear life. And boy, there's nothing more purifying than that. It's like this morning I got off the cushion and I felt like every atom of my being had been washed clean. I swear to you. It was just so beautiful. It was like, oh, like purification. Yeah. And I have to tell you, you know, by the third sit, you know, I was going into move because my legs were getting really tired. You know, my legs get tired too. I just go deeply into move, deeply into move. I don't let the pain sensation emerge long enough to notice it. You know, I know it's there because it's like knocking on the door, but I open the door. I just keep going back into the blindness. And then the bell rings. Fortunately, I get to ring the bell. You know? But I have to, you know, look at the clock. You know, I don't ring it when I want to, I ring it when I'm supposed to. And then the bell rings, and then I uncross my legs and get up and have to go into the bathroom and just think, oh, I feel so, like every atom is purified. Yeah? So this was what the Bodhidharma was trying to tell Emperor Wu of Lyon and did not succeed. But here we all are practicing Piquan together. So wonderful. Facing the wall of move. Let's just plunge into it. Let's just plunge into it. It's the most wonderful thing in the world. Emperor Wu of Liang asked great teacher Bodhidharma, what is the highest meaning of the holy truth? Bodhidharma said, there is no meaning, there is no truth, there is no holiness. Vast emptiness. Mushin. Wushin. Who are you facing me? Don't know. Don't know. So that state of being unable to say, I just don't know, that's the best state in the world, right? Purest state. The emperor didn't understand. Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze, came to Shaolin and faced the wall for 9 years, just like you. His legs hurt too, by the way. He was tired too, by the way. Empty, nothing holy. The approach is far off. Succeeding, he swings the axe without injuring the nose. Failing, he drops the pitcher without looking back. Success or failure are trivial. they don't matter. It's like being worried about the minutes of the 4-H club, right? Still and silent, coolly he sat at Shaolin. In silence, he completely brought up the true imperative. The clear moon of autumn turns its frosty disk. The Milky Way thin, the dipper hangs down the tan from the night. When we sit in deep Mushin, we connect ourselves to the whole universe. So help me. In succession, the robe and bowl have been imparted to descendants. From this, humans and divinities have made medicine and disease. This is deeper than the human. It's deeper than the divine. It's deeper than sickness. It's deeper than health. And it's right here.